Rockwired Sound in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places. This is Rockwired Radio Profiles with your host, Brian Lush, exclusively at Rockwired.com. Today, Rockwired profiles the classic alternative rock sound of Concrete Blonde and their classic 1990 album, Bloodletting. Stick around for more. Rockwired Radio Profiles is a production of Rockwired Media LLC, a limited liability company. Please stand by. Happy Halloween from Rockwired Radio Profiles, exclusively at Rockwired.com. I'm your host, Brian Lush, and the music is out there. I couldn't think of a better artist and album to showcase on All Hallows Eve than the legendary Concrete Blonde and their classic album, Bloodletting. This year, the band's seminal recording is 20 years old. That's right. It was released when alternative rock was called cutting edge, and lead singer Johnette Napolitano and the boys outdid themselves on their third album with songs that showcase the darker side of love and life. I had the honor of speaking with Johnette Napolitano of Concrete Blonde about the 20th anniversary of Bloodletting, and you'll hear all of that in just a few minutes. From the album Bloodletting, here is Concrete Blonde with Bloodletting, the vampire song. We'll be right back. From the classic album Bloodletting, that was Concrete Blonde with Bloodletting, the Vampire Song. Visit Concrete Blonde at their official website, www.concreteblondeofficialwebsite.com. I had a chance to speak with Johnette Napolitano of Concrete Blonde over the phone, and here's how it went.
Well, Johnette, it's been 20 years since the release of Bloodletting. 20 years after the fact, how does the album resonate for you?
Well, I hadn't heard it in a long time, and we played it for the first time when we rehearsed before June, before we went out in the States, the first part of the tour. We just got back from Australia, which was really great, because we got our first gold record in Australia, which was Bloodletting, and we were able to go back and be with the original company, which is Mushroom, who gave us our first gold record, and just kind of relive the whole thing with them, and it was just fantastic. I mean, it was just so much fun, and it was really nice to see people happy. You know, I'm not so close to the material at this point in time that it's the emotional exercise to perform it that it was back, you know, when I was a little more unstable. but I'm able to sit back and, you know, and enjoy, actually listen to some of the songs as a listener. And so even when I'm playing them, you know, it's just such the whole set. We don't do Bloodletting for front to back, because there were two records before that, and we wouldn't have gotten to the point where we were, we would have been successful without the audience that followed us for the first two records. So we kind of make everybody happy, basically. It's just kind of a greatest hit set we've been doing with, obviously, you know, with a lot of the Bloodletting stuff, but it's just nice to see people so happy, you know. It sounds really corny and everything, but man, I mean, there's so much crap going on, you know. I mean, we went out in the middle of the British Petroleum New Orleans thing, and you know, and everything that's been going on, and it's just nice to see, you know, people. Overwhelmingly, the sentiment was, you know, people were really happy to go out and hear some of their favorite songs for an hour and a half, and it just made all the difference in the world. You know, our audience, you know, 20 years later, some of their kids now that have, you know, weren't even born, you know, are into it, and that was really cool. That was an unexpected thing, and you know, people our age that have been raising their kids or whatever, you know, are happy to go out and see music, see songs they know and what they understand without being like, you know, we're an interesting generation of people. Rock and roll's always been there for us, you know, different than, say, my parents, who, you know, rock and roll just came into being. I mean, they grew up on the 50s, you know, the 50s, Bill Haley was like the first rock and roll, and Little Richard, and all that. That was the first thing that of my parents knew of rock and roll, but it had been Rat Pack before that, and, you know, a whole 50s music, so, but we've had rock and roll, so it's just kind of it's great that we can still do it, and we're still around, and people still want to hear it. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is sort of a multi-generational thing that we've got. I noticed that when I saw Blondie, and saw like 10-year-olds in the audience. You know,
isn't that great?
It is.
So cool. Yeah, that's really cool, because, you know, people are just like, oh, it's just such a rock and roll keeps you young. You know, I mean, I firmly believe it's just we don't know. You know, you see somebody with a guitar, and you just go rock and roll, and it all makes sense. It just seems to not be have anything to do with age anymore, because it's always been there.
I see. And going back to Bloodletting a little bit, I understand that Shout Factory re-released the album without your consent. Is that true, or?
You know, apparently they've been talking to somebody, and we didn't know it back in earlier in the year, but we weren't. No, we weren't party to that at all. At all. Never spoke once to anyone from the company, who I hear is a good company. But when we heard about the re-release, and we'd been hearing from fans and people from friends saying, hey, it's 20 years, and it had been, you know, a trend to do anniversary records, you know, for this people who are lucky to still be around after 20 years. And so we said, well, shit, you know, and my dad had died, you know, last year, and he would have said to do it. You know, I mean, it's been very much a whole experience for me. And my father was really a fan, and he would have said, "Go and do it." You know, if people want you, go out and do it. And we were surprised at how well. And how the people, you know, our agent was happy, and people seem happy, and fans seem happy. And we're like, well, this is cool. Let's go out and do it. And then we heard about the re-release date, and I said, well, you know what? You know, I want to be a part of this. You know, this is cool. And but you know, before we take it on the road with us and get involved, let's see a copy. You know, and so they FedExed me a copy, and it had it was no big deal. It had like a live Little Wing on it, and it had another version of Tomorrow Wendy on it. So it was essentially the same record with a couple of cuts on it. But the thing that pissed me off was that they had the photos in it were of the wrong band. It was the band from the first record, which was Harry Rushikoff on drums, and it clearly says on the record Paul Thompson, who's, you know,
Roxy
nobody
music.
Special. He's just in Roxy Music. Yeah, nobody important or anything. He's the drummer on that record, and it was our drummer for years. And I had so much stuff, like from Australia, so many photo session outtakes and everything of that band, and it was just really either number one, sloppy, and somebody made a mistake, which was a sloppy mistake, or two, they deliberately packaged a younger, wackier looking band to appeal to a younger audience. Either one of them is just not forgivable to me. So it's just kind of like, you know, and my fans, I think, know me well to know that, like, you know, this isn't a mistake I would make. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Obviously. So it's kind of like, you know, there's certain things, you just go, okay, well, that's a fuck up, and it's just, you know, it's going to happen. You know, like listing the wrong publishing on True. On our first record, there's a song, you know, called True, and and the publishing is listed to the ABC guys, you know. I know your love is true. That's who's listed on the record. So you go, you know, I think that's on the record, the reissue. And they get all these sordid, stupid details of my personal life, like, on this record that they didn't ask me about either. But, and I'm like, for all that research, you guys actually get the wrong publishing information for the wrong song, the wrong songwriter. I mean, way to go, you know? I just... it just blows my mind, you know? But something, you know, on that reissue, that was important. And Paul, who's, you know, I just heard from the other day, and he's doing Roxy stuff this year, and Brian Ferry just did new stuff, and so it's just like, it was a sloppy mistake, and it wasn't something that I could, you know, really 100% get behind, you know. I was disappointed.
I see, and understandably so, but, When Bloodletting was released, I mean, it was an interesting time for the band. I mean, you lost a member and gained the drummer from Roxy Music, and in a way, it's like the production value went up a little from the first two albums. Talk about that time of the making of Bloodletting.
Well, it's ironic and kind of bittersweet and sad and kinds of corny adjectives, because Harry, our first drummer, who had actually turned us on to Chris Tangerides, who wound up as a co-producer with us on Bloodletting, and who's just fantastic. I love Chris. Made famous now from Anvil, the movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's in Anvil. He did Anvil. So but he did Thin Lizzy, and I was always a big Thin Lizzy fan, and I was I really liked the emotional range, and I'm a Phil Lynott fan anyway. But so we'd met Chris, but Harry just is unfortunately wired, a brilliantly talented, an amazingly psychic person, very sensitive person. A very compassionate person, one of the more talented and complicated people I've ever met in my life. It just is wired backwards. It seemed like the better we did, the more he couldn't handle it. The more self-destructive he got, and you know, even after he left the band once, and we you know, and he this was the night before we started Bloodletting. You know, we had a show in London, and he was hanging out with some extremely negative influences, and who happened to be dead now. You know what I mean? So it's like, it couldn't happen. It couldn't happen. It was an important record. I needed his focus, and the pressure was on. And he just dropped the ball. He missed the plane on the way to England. you know, he missed rehearsals for the London show. We ended up checking his drums, and famously and always, he would pop up at the very fucking last minute, and it was just, you know, or you didn't know if he was going to show up at all. And he'd had heroin problems and drug problems for a long time, and there's only, you know, we just couldn't take it. And luckily, the night before we went in the studio, Chris's wife knew Paul Thompson's girlfriend at the time, and Paul was there and saw the show, and right away said, "I want to play with these guys." Like, he just really loved the band. And, you know, Paul had done a lot of things besides Roxy, a lot of really good stuff, but I mean, Roxy, what else really do you need to do?
Right, right.
So it was, so obviously that was a thrill for us, and that upped the game considerably, just because Paul is, of course, an incredible musician, and the songs were the songs, and Chris was Chris. He was a real producer, and we worked at Zomba Studios, which is a pretty, you know, one of the biggest studios in London, and just, yeah, it went up a lot, and we were a better band because we'd been playing on the road for so long by that point, you know, that we were just a better band. And it was a bummer about Harry, because, you know, what was the point of him spending, I mean, what's the point of being in a band when you're 7 months in a van and, you know, sleeping in, you know, in dressing rooms and getting lice in your hair and finally working your way up to one hotel room between all three of you? What was the fucking point of all that if you were going to crash and burn right before the most successful record? And so it was, but he just was wired that way. And so in reality, you just go, well, I can't, you know, how can you ever count on somebody like that? It's nerve-wracking, as anybody who's dealt with that situation knows, you know. When is it's just a bummer, you know, and it made me sad, but at the same time, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do, because the music is the most important thing, always, first, last, and always, you know. So and I was not gonna let, at that point, anything hold us back from making this record, you know. It was really a drag, you know.
With Paul Thompson being the new addition to the band, what was it that you thought he brought to the table, not just musically, but personality-wise, that made it work?
Well, stability. He's very much like the Taurus bull sort of a dude, you know, a quiet mountain of a guy, you know. You know, he's Northern English, you know, I mean, he's from where Brian's from and everything, and he's just got that sort of earthiness about him. And he's a heavy, harder hitter, which I really, really liked. Gabriel Ramirez, who's our drummer now, he's hard-hitting like Paul was. But, you know, it really was, it was a shot in the arm for us to have Paul Thompson in the band. I mean, I'm sitting here, like, I just learned to play bass, like, you know, in 1981 or something, you know. So it was kind of like, well, I'm in a band with Paul Thompson, and it gave my confidence a real boost, I think, you know. It was real cool to have Paul in the band, and he's just an amazing drummer, an amazing musician, and it was just amazing to hear him play in the studio. He would just lay that stuff down like it was nothing, you know. It was good, and he was very stabilizing, whereas Harry had been really wild, and so had I been, you know, and it was, you know, it was time, so at some point, you know, we were both either going to go completely down or keep it going, you know. So, and that was the crucial record, it was a crucial time, it was like, you know, there was a lot of pressure because our label had just done a deal with EMI, and we were the first record released under that period, the first between the relationship, and it was really important, you know. The label wanted to deliver for the distributor, and the distributor had a lot of hopes for the label, and everybody, it was just the perfect storm of things, you know. It's just beyond just having a good record, it's just beyond, you know, it was just, no lie, we had the money, we had the promotion, and it was just a good time. Everybody was really working together and believed in it, and we worked our asses off, and we toured with Sting, which was great, and that was a great opportunity, and we just had a lot going for us, you know, a lot of things, you know, it takes years of work to get to the perfect moment where everything comes together sometimes, you know, and that's what it was.
Visit the band at their official website, www.concreteblondeofficialwebsite.com. From their classic album, Bloodletting, here is Concrete Blonde once again with Joey. And the songs off of Bloodletting, were they written specifically for the recording, or were they songs that you had for a while before going into the studio, or?
No, those all came hard and fast, because I'd spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and I still do, actually. I'm going down next month. But I'd spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and that was very much when everybody was into the Anne Rice, you know, the original Twilight.
Yes, yes.
And I was really, really into it. And in New Orleans, it was the first place we'd been as a band touring. You know, the first tour we went on, it started in New Orleans, and it was, you know, I'm from Southern California. It was a whole different world to me. I mean, the South in the first place, but New Orleans was just so exotic and mysterious, and it still is, you know. And I was just quite taken with it. It was very rich, and a lot of the greatest writers have lived there and been inspired by the city, and so am I. So I really immersed myself in it and came out. And that was it was a hard time for me because I had been on the road a long time. I'd lived in London for a while, and I was really displaced for a long time, just bouncing around like a ping pong ball, you know. And so it was just a state of mind. It was a very dark time, really. You know, I was very unsure of the record after it was done. I didn't quite know if anybody would get it or not. And we went into the studio, and Jim didn't like Joey, and I was bummed.
And that became the hit.
I know. But, you know, I mean, whatever.
I know, really. I mean, Clem Burke didn't like Heart of Glass, so what, you know?
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, that makes me feel better. Well, that's funny. And, well, you know, here's another thing. He didn't like True either, and he wrote that, and I thought that was so beautiful that we kept the instrumental on it, the original. The original was an instrumental, and then I put, you know, vocals on it, but I love the piece of music so much, but he didn't like it at all. That was his music. He hated it, and I thought it was, I still think it's just so gorgeous, you know. I mean, that's our theme song in a way.
Yeah, and you know, just listening to it again, and I have not bought this new re-release. I'm just relying on my old 1990 CD to listen to. You know, it holds up. It holds up.
You know, I was just saying, it's just like I had between computers, I lost so much music, and it was just, oh my God, to, you know. And I want to go back to CDs so that I can make sure to back stuff up again. And, you know, I don't want to lose any more music from just downloads. Although I love it. I love downloading. It's great to be able to go get something right away, but it's just like when you lose it, it's just gone, you know.
Yeah, you do.
And then I don't remember. I mean, Jesus Christ. The great Western theme songs by the Prague Symphony Orchestra, and it was like $40, you know. And I'm like, oh, shit, I can't find it. So it's like, I mean, that's an expensive record.
Well, you know, the embarrassing truth with me is that I only started downloading since in April.
Oh, really?
When I started the show.
It's a blast. And you can find, and not only that, you can find stuff that you just can't find the CDs.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So,
exactly.
I mean, it's great. I was a big download fan, and I still will, I'm sure. I found Vivian Stanchel records on, well, I found those on Amazon, actually, but I love the internet just because you can find stuff that you can't, you know.
Yeah.
Even, I'd love to support record stores, but they're only so big. I mean, who carries Vivian Stanchel?
That's right. Or Roxy Music. I couldn't, my favorite.
Oh, Roxy Music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't find the album that had Virginia Plain on it, but anyway, talk about how music began for you.
Go to YouTube, because all that's on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sorry,
I'm sorry. How did music begin for you? How did that start? I've always been curious how you got into music.
Well, I was real small. I was 5 years old, and my dad, someone owed him money, and couldn't pay him, and I think he took it out in trade in this old upright piano that my parents had in the living room, and that the Wizard of Oz came out, and I watched the Wizard of Oz, and like, of course, that was, you know, the mark of a generation, you know. It's just like,
right.
and that was the first time it was on, you know, and I went over the piano and I started playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and I just started playing by ear, and I was only 5 years old, but I'll never forget the way my parents looked at each other, like I literally was from space, you know, and because it was a real strange thing to them, and so they gave me, for I think it was around my eighth birthday, they gave me a guitar, so, you know, that was it. I've never been without a guitar since. you know. One little, there was one stolen out of my house when I was waitressing back in the, like 1979, and I was devastated. But I got another one. I sleep in my car, but I had to have a guitar. Absolutely. It's just something that I could never not do. I don't do it. You know, it's not something I wake up and do every day. As a matter of fact, some of the best times we ever had as a band is when Jim and I still had day jobs. I can't say I ever knew Harry to have a day job. But we would, you know, just literally just lock ourselves in after and blow off the steam for like 4 or 5 hours, just smoking and drinking and playing. And when it became a job, like, you know, it's when a band, you know, we were just talking about this on the way back from Australia, actually. It's like when your worst competition is yourself, if you've done well, you know, competing against other bands and trying to, you know, getting, you know, having a goal and, like, you know, there's competition and there's, you know, and you know, what's a good band and all that. You you're the best you can and everything, but then once you've done good work and it's been actually acknowledged by people, you know, then you can, it's easy to slip up and say, as an artist, you know, well, do I do that again, and that's what people want, and that's what I did the best, or do I take a chance, or do I, we just saw Get Him to the Greek on the plane, or do we write African Child, and, you know, that was so funny. Oh my God, we were dying, and we were on a plane, so we were all trying to be quiet. Oh my God. But you know, it's hard to. It's, you know, you have to really, and at the end of the day, you have to be true to yourself as an artist, because that's what you were in the first place. Hopefully, you know. And I've been doing this too long to really know anything else, but how to do it the way I do it.
And what's next for you musically? I mean, is there going to be another Concrete Blonde record, or a solo project, or another project? Because I know you balance a lot of musical projects, you know.
I gotta really, like, not stop doing that, because I have that ADD sort of thing where it's good for me to work on more things at a time. Keeps me interested and fresh. And what I was trying to get around to say is that I don't force myself to play music every day, and I do other things, and it does keep your mind, keeps it fresh. I don't want to feel like somebody standing over me with a whip going, like, you got to write a song today or whatever, you know. I feel like it's great. If I don't, it's great. I've definitely got a solo project with a conceptual thing that I'm working on, but I'm not going to, I'm just going to do that in my own time when I want to. You can only make so many plans. I have been working in the studio on some stuff for the last year and a half, with a couple of other people, a violin player, Charlene Hang, who is great, and Gabriel, our drummer, who I've been, you know, working with for a long time. And I'm thinking now that could very easily turn into a Concrete Blonde record. So I think we're going to look to going in the studio maybe the first week of January, and we're working with Ann Catalino, who we've worked with for years, back to the, even when Mark Morvan and I did that Carpenters record, you know, If I Were a Carpenter, she worked on that, so she goes way back to Mexican Moon and way back to a whole lot of things, so it's kind of nice to hear it sound that way again, you know, and she's a brilliant engineer, and we're in a good studio, and it was fun. The tour was great, and we're in control more than we ever have been now, and that's why it's fun. You know, we just blew down to Australia, and it was pretty brutal schedule. We did 4 cities in less than a week, and if you've never had Australian jet lag right before you walk on stage, you haven't lived. it was just amazing, and so. But we loved it, and so we're going to get back with the Mushroom People again, I guess, at South by Southwest next year. Ian just called me yesterday, and we just didn't have enough fun. We need to extend it, so we're going to do that. But that's why it was fun. It was because it was fast shows, you know. We like playing every night when we're out, no matter how we feel. We'd rather be playing every night than sitting around, you know, in a bar, in a hotel room, and doing anything, you know. It's fun for us to play, so... So we're going to see how the new stuff sounds in January, and hopefully get, you know, do a couple of shows earlier in the year and just see what happens, really. You know, we know we can do that much, so there's no use in making any big long plans, because that's not what we want to do anymore. You know, it just doesn't make sense on any level, you know. So we're just kind of, you know, kind of compromising on the whole rhythm of life. You know, we'll make a few plans, but then things come up, and you want to be ready and available when cool things come up too, you know. So I don't want to structure my life that much. That's not why I moved to Joshua Tree. That's not why I became a musician in the first place, you know. I want to have some freedom about the rhythm of my life and not have to, you know, clock in and clock out. And on tour, that's what it is, pretty much. So it's just, after years of that, you're like, geez, I just like to eat when I really want to and sleep when I really want to, and then I'll feel so much better about making music when I really want to, you know. So it's just a nicer way to live.
And what kind of place do you think you're coming from as a songwriter these days, as opposed to, you know, when writing Bloodletting?
More about stories. I'm now more, I don't want to say external, because that's not necessarily the right word. It's any time I've ever written, it's always been like when I see this sentiment or this idea popping up this often in my life, it's easy to personally relate to it and interpret it, because I always believe you should write about what you know. So let's say, you know, this one thing I'm working on is very biographical, and it happens to be about a lot of other people, but I can relate to it because of certain circumstances in my life, and that's sort of like maybe a method acting kind of a thing. But I'm just a more mature person. My emotions aren't all churned up, you know. I'm in a more serene place. I can still get pissed off and stuff, but I don't want to be. You know, I mean, I like life. It's been good to me. It's been really tough, but it's given me a lot, and I've just come through a lot, and I've seen, more importantly, I've seen other people come through things much more difficult, that are much more difficult. You know, it's all a matter of perspective, and it's just a really good place to be. So now, how can I, you know, I want to tell, I'm really into, like, the history and ghosts and haunted things, and I believe that there's a collective consciousness, and that we're here to tell stories that other people can't tell. I mean, a lot of people will say that to me, you know, thanks for saying things that I can't, you know, but expressing it so well. So this is what I learned on Bloodletting, is I thought this record is so personal that no one's going to relate to it but me. I was totally shocked when so many people related to a song like Joey, because I thought, wow, this is only my experience. But it turned out to be everybody's experience in the world, you know, and it really, really taught me a lot about being human. You know, it was like, the closer you get to your own truth, the more universal it becomes. And so I still find that, but I'm not necessarily finding it from the same emotional well as I had before, because I've made peace with a lot of things, you know, and myself. And so, but there's plenty of unfinished business that I see around me, and there's enough inspiration there that it needs to be talked about in one way or another, you know.
Visit the band at their official website, www.concreteblondeofficialwebsite.com. From their classic album Bloodletting, here is Concrete Blonde once more with Tomorrow Wendy.
Walk.
That's going to do it for this edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles. A special thanks goes out to Johnette Napolitano of Concrete Blonde for her time and, more importantly, her music. Visit Concrete Blonde at their official website, www.concreteblondeofficialwebsite.com. Happy Halloween from Rockwired. I'm Brian Lush, and remember, keep your eyes forward, never look back, and make it up as you go. Rockwired Radio Profiles is a production of Rockwired Media LLC, a limited liability company, and is available exclusively at rockwired.com. Musical aptitude since 2005.